Welcome. I'm Laura Weber. Obviously, I'm the music director of the orchestra, and I'm so happy to be here with you tonight and really looking forward to this program of really wonderful, varied, but kind of connected music. Tonight is our season finale, which means that during intermission, if you are so inclined, you can renew for next year. And we're playing some really cool stuff, like Beethoven's Seventh Symphony and the Firebird Suite and Prokofiev's Third Piano Concerto and the First Symphony of Tchaikovsky and a bunch of other stuff. And it's exciting and we're looking forward to it. Tonight's music launches with some welcome, whimsical fun. This little piece of Stravinsky, his second little suite, it's in four movements, a little march, a little waltz, a little polka, and a little gallop. Each one is a perfect little musical miniature. And in these pieces, we really hear Stravinsky's gift for comedic timing in composition. What you find is it's rooted in tonality, but you'll hear in the texture of the orchestration that the clarinets are kind of in their own tonal harmonic land, and the trumpets and trombones are kind of in their own land, and the piano and strings are kind of in their own land, and somehow it all works out. The march starts, in case you were a little drowsy or looking for your program, you'll hear a fanfare in the trumpet and trombone and a flourish in the piano and the strings to grab your attention. And then listen for this jaunty, little awkward trumpet melody that sounds like it's trying to be in the right place, but these brooding clarinets way in the distant softness are in a totally different world. Here is the very beginning of the march of Stravinsky. Following that is a waltz that starts off sort of gently and normally, the way you would expect a waltz to begin. The clarinets are the incessant left hand of the piano. These were piano pieces before they were orchestrated. And they play the oom-pa-pa, 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 oom-pa-pa throughout, literally throughout. They never stop. At a certain point, there's a beautiful waltz tune that's pretty straightforward until it's not. It gets fragmented and the piccolo kind of takes little pieces of it. The bassoon chimes in at the end of a line. A trumpet sort of tries to bring everyone back on track. And then the flute goes completely nuts, way up in the register with these crazy fast grace notes. And what is going on? And somewhere in the middle of this lovely scene, the clarinets kind of jump off the merry-go-round for a minute, and the tempo changes, but it definitely feels like we are still spinning. It's a brilliant little waltz. Then there's a polka, which is, for all intents and purposes, completely normal, except, of course, it's not. It's goofy and wacky. Again, melodies that sound, that would otherwise be normal in shape and form, are shared among instruments that aren't normally paired. Like a flute and a trombone play a very sort of heavy tune. And the last movement of it is a gallop, which if you're a fan of Petrushka, you're going to hear most definitely some similarities that are pretty strong between that gallop and the Russian dance of Petrushka. And in the middle of this rush of this gallop, there's a middle section that's contrasting. It's a little trio, and a trio section. It starts with another incessant oom-pa-pa-pa, oom-pa-pa-pa, oom-pa-pa-pa in the orchestra, and over it is a solo line that's shared in octaves by a tuba and a trumpet, and they sound kind of like they wandered in off the street and are, you know, had a little one too many. But it fits in somehow. I'd like to play you that little moment from the middle section of the gallop. Look at that.
program with music of Robert Schumann. I confessed to the orchestra, I don't know if it was which rehearsal, maybe it was the dress rehearsal, that I've been secretly, or maybe not so secretly, avoiding Schumann symphonies since I started being a conductor. I don't know what happened that I decided that I couldn't handle it, or I didn't know what to do with him, or the usual argument is that there's so many challenges about the orchestration that they're difficult to pull off. Schumann has a bad rap as a symphonist. It's not fair to him because his compositional gift is so incredibly unique. He was the most romantic of the romantics of that period of the romantic era. He was, I'm sure many of you know, his life was cut short and burdened heavily by mental illness. What would have been a bipolar disorder diagnosis now is what he had then. He was a writer. He was a composer who was really also an author and a poet and a music critic. And he grew up surrounded by books and writing, and what his literature lit up his imagination. He, in his manic state, composed an extraordinary amount of music. He probably outpaced Mozart if you add up only the manic part of his life. The output, the number of incredible songs and piano works and chamber music, and four beautiful symphonies and an opera. His mood swings are audible in his melodic writing, his fraught relationships evident in the impassioned notes that he puts in his music. What happened to him, he was to have been a piano virtuoso, but injured his hand. There's stories about how it happened. He was studying with Friedrich Wieck, who was Clara Wieck's father. Clara being the future Clara Schumann. Robert and Clara fell hard for each other, and Friedrich was going to have nothing of it, would not allow this union. When Clara was of age and she felt a return of his affections and wanted to marry, her father was so set against it, he moved her away, he stopped all their correspondence, they had to write to each other through an intermediary. They composed to each other, they wrote melodies for each other in each other's music to stay in touch. Eventually, Clara went to court in Dresden against her own father to have the right to marry. It took years. This man totally discredited his own daughter and totally discredited Robert to avoid this union from happening, but they were never dissuaded, and they were finally married. And it wasn't that long after they're finally together and building a family and having some real joy that he wrote this symphony that we're going to play tonight, which is his fourth symphony, but really it's his second symphony. He wrote it in 1841, and after the success of the first symphony, and he was trying something totally new and radical. He was writing a symphony that was one whole thought, without pause. You can hear in it four movements very distinctly. But there are connective tissues between the movements that he composed very specifically, so that it was really almost like the first tone poem. And what happened to this work is really odd. He normally had his works premiered by Mendelssohn. By the way, we wouldn't be as familiar as we are with the Beethoven Fourth Piano Concerto without Mendelssohn either. He tended to go find the really good stuff and bring it back and say, wait, you didn't hear this the right way the first time. And of course, he was a brilliant conductor, so he would bring these works to life in a way that gave them their due. But this didn't happen for Schumann's second symphony in 1841. It was poorly prepared, poorly played, and received in a confused manner because of this new radical idea that the audience didn't know what was going on. The publisher wasn't interested in publishing it for lots of reasons, and everyone put it on the shelf. Robert, first and foremost, Clara right behind him, no, we're putting it away. And 10 years later, he came back to it. But after 10 years of progression of his illness, more struggles, more triumphs,
more skill, more experience. He recomposed so much of it, and he changed a lot of the orchestration, and it was clearly what he wanted. He wanted this version that we're playing tonight, that is played most often. The holdout was Brahms. Brahms really believed in the first version, and there's lots of good reasons to believe in it. But I just want to give you a taste. I'm going to play just a bunch of little themes from it so that you'll have a sense of this connective tissue idea. It begins, the music is in three beats at the beginning, and oddly, he chooses to start on the third beat. And he does this throughout the symphony, where he begins one pulse earlier than you expect, and it creates this suspended tension over the bar line. So the introduction is this beautiful, slow, wandering, stepwise melody, clearly looking in the darkness for some place to be. This is the slow introduction to the symphony. From the floor to the ceiling, and drives forward, clearly agitated, clearly a struggling theme. This is the first theme of the first movement. There is a contrasting sort of secondary theme that's lighter in character, but the real thrust of this first movement is the development section, the middle. It starts with a giant E flat that is in your face. It is a hand against progress. It stops everything. It is Clara's father. And clearly the burden is pressed at the beginning of this development. And then he does something really unique for this time period, messing around with the form and the expectations that the audience would have of what they hear at this point in a work like this. You'll hear the first theme I just played for you in the background, but beyond it are new thematic ideas in the trombones that develop, and then they grow and lead into this new musical idea, which is just a series of very majestic chords in a dotted rhythmic form, tom, pa-pom, pa-pom. And that becomes very important throughout the symphony. So here's this new idea in the development section. Development.
we push and pull between these worlds, very, very romantic and very fierce all at the same time. The second movement is just beautiful and intimate. It's really chamber music, and it contains in it two very beautiful, different melodies. The first is a melody shared by the oboe and the cello equally, a beautiful combination of sounds. Another song, this is the romance.
Torturing us, you know, the things that he wants us to do. But Beethoven wrote this piece during a period of time in his life which was so interesting, because he started going deaf in 1800 when he was about 30. And he became very, very depressed about it. So much so that he considered killing himself. And he went to the Heiligenstadt to vacation, I guess. And there he wrote the famous letter to his brother called the Heiligenstadt Testament, in which he basically said, this is so unfair to be a composer, to lose your hearing. It would be like a painter losing their sight. What can I do? I'm just at the beginning of my career. Because Beethoven was a late bloomer. He was not a prodigy like Mozart. And so he decided, after writing that letter, I guess he kind of got it out of his system, you know, it was sort of psychotherapy, you know, in a way.
Yeah.
And he then decided, no, I have much more to say, thank goodness. And so around 1806, he was writing all along, and then in 1806, he had this burst of energy, and he wrote the fourth and the fifth concerto, the Opus 59 Razumovsky quartets, which are the great quartets. He also wrote Opus 53 Waldstein, and he wrote a couple of other things. I think the Prometheus, he wrote that as well, and the Eroica. I mean, he was writing basically one piece a month, which is mind-blowing when you think about it.
Greatest, most.
They're the greatest pieces of his time, I think. And I was having dinner. I think I told you this funny story on Sunday night.
Oh, tell them.
This is a great story. So I tell you the story only because I use music now when I perform in concert, even as a concerto soloist. Because as many of you will probably be able to, you know, sympathize with me, I can play concertos I learned when I was 12 and 13. Mm. But when you learn a concerto when you're 62 or 61, it doesn't stick in here, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
I think I have too much music in there.
Yes.
And I gotta unload some of it first.
Yes.
But Nick McGeegan, who's a really good friend of mine, he and David Bowles is my audio engineer. And if I might just say, I have two CDs I brought for you tonight if you'd like to look at them.
Oh, yeah, you can meet her and talk to her and get her music.
Yeah. And as you well know, next year, 2020, is Beethoven's 250th anniversary. And so we're playing Beethoven all over the place. And I actually, luckily, got to play at St. Martin in the Fields in London last year. I got to play some Beethoven there. Beethoven Society invited me, and I'm going back to play more Beethoven, but never mind. Nick said to me over dinner, he said, do you know Beethoven premiered this piece in 1808 on December the 22nd, 6:30 at night. It was freezing, freezing cold. They did not have central air or central heating. And so he had a 4 or 5 hour concert on which there were the two symphonies, I think it was 4 and 5, plus this concerto, plus some other overtures like Coriolanus or whatever, I don't know. But he just decided he needed to do this. It was a benefit concert for himself. So he wanted to make sure he made enough money so he wouldn't have to worry about it. And Nick told me that Beethoven came out with Schindler it was published by then, the fourth concerto. And he came out with Schindler, and they had candles on the piano, of course, right? They didn't have lights or anything. And because he was conducting from the piano, and after he played the beautiful opening chord, he stood up and conducted the orchestra and knocked the candle. There was this whole mess. But this concerto, what I'd like to just tell you very briefly, and I'm sorry, I wasn't going to talk this much. Okay, but I'm a professor and I can't help it. So, what's really special about this concerto is that it starts not with a big overture. The orchestra usually plays the main theme and the second theme, and then finally they go, ta-da, and then the pianist comes in. And you get to sit there the whole time, nervous, chewing your fingernails, worrying, you know. No, this concerto starts with the piano. And the piano plays a very short 5-bar phrase, which is unusual already, because it's usually 4, 6, or 8, but this is a 5-bar phrase. And it's like a prayer, basically. That's how I feel about it. And then the orchestra answers this call to prayer by the pianist the pianist ends in G major, and so the orchestra should politely answer in G major or D major. They don't. They answer in B major. And it's so nutty. I mean, you just think, what's wrong with this? This is, it's very surprising, don't you think?
It has a warmth. Oh, thank you. There's something about that moment. It's like the most warm feeling in music, that it's a major third higher. What's that? It sets you on a different path right away.
And what I think is extraordinary about this is that, you know, the first, second, and third concertos, the pianist and the orchestra are kind of apart. By the time you get to this fourth concerto, what you're going to notice tonight is that the orchestra partners the pianist. So I give them this theme, and then they answer me in B major, and then they go on. And then I play something, and then they answer me. So it's a complete partnership. It's like playing chamber music with 120 people. And so it's a very spectacular relationship. And so you have to really like your conductor and orchestra to play.
Yeah.
And then the second movement, I think, is even more incredible. And what I was thinking about today all day, about what would I say to you that would help me feel calmer and for you to hear things in the music, is the second movement starts out with the orchestra almost in a stentorian, you know, way, saying, ah, right? And then the pianist answers, but in pianissimo. The orchestra plays fortissimo. And they're kind of, what would you say, what's the character of the orchestra's part?
They're not going to allow you to pass. They're not allowing you in. This is our territory, and you may not enter. Who do you think you are?
So the pianist decides, I'm going to answer them in pianissimo. And the orchestra says, fine. And then they come back in, you know, like that, right?
Yeah.
And the pianist is completely unfeathered and says, pianissimo. And the pianist says, pianissimo. And then the orchestra says, wait a minute.
Then we cut you off.
Yeah, you're going to be mad.
Too early, and we stop you.
Yeah, they get a little aggressive with the pianist. And the pianist still plays pianissimo. It's like, oh, fine, no bother. And finally, the pianist tames the orchestra, and the orchestra finally becomes quite wimpy, and they get very quiet.
What I say to the, what I've said to the orchestra is, we give up our dynamic, but not our rhythm.
Yeah.
She's very legato throughout, and we are not. And it's very, we give in, but not all the way. And it's sad. It's tragic.
Anyway, I win. That's the one. One really wonderful thing that happens this week is that both our mothers came to our rehearsals. And it was adorable because Laura's mother had some medical problems and she came and she was able to come to the church, right?
Yep.
And it was so delightful to meet her mother, who is quite a presence. And I think that's why Laura and I get along so well, because we were raised by divas.
Yes.
And, my mother is turning 100 this year. And the entire orchestra was so sweet, and I asked them if they'd sing happy birthday, and they did. And in true diva form, my mother said to me all the way home, thank you so much for playing just for me.
That's true, and they don't give up their rhythm, do they? And then the last movement does another weird thing with the key. It ends, we drop a whole step down beyond where we should be, and we start in C major. And I know, you may not be tracking where we are in space and time, tonality-wise, but this matters, your ear knows. And it is surprising and wonderful.
Oh,
possibly wins a romp. It's really, really fun.
Yeah.
And anyway, I love Laura. You should love her. She's amazing.
Yeah.
And this is, we feel like we've known each other forever. I hope we get to work more together.
I'm sure we will.
Anyway, thank you for listening to the ramble.
It is an incredible gift for you to come here and perform with us. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And thank you for coming.